Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 27th. I'm Ray Graff. It's final exam day on the Science Forum. Our scientists have been here all year preparing. So if you have a question for our panel of experts, now is the time to call 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Of course, you can email us if you wish. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. It's the final Science Forum of 2018. Try not to cry, but do call. We'll be back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum for the final time in 2018. Our experts are ready to respond to your questions, so give us a call. Right now you have a very good chance of getting through. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. The number, 800-348-2551, on this Science Forum. And let's have our panel of experts sign in, please.
Happy almost New Year. It's Barbara Brabets, biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
Oh, and I'm Ed Stander, and I'm also from SUNY Cobleskill. And I cover geology, astronomy, environmental science, anything that Barbara or Jim can't answer.
Well, Jim, you're retired, but the rest of you, the other two, you're on break now, right?
We are no longer teaching classes
for
a couple
nice?
Of weeks.
Are you enjoying yourself?
Well, I did wake up way past my alarm today.
Oh, that's great.
That felt, if there was an initial moment of panic, and then it was like, eh, I'm good.
Why set the alarm then?
Well, you know, maybe I'm just too stupid to figure out how to turn it off.
Well, you know.
And we are still working. At least some of us are still working.
Oh, I just said where classes are. Yeah, there's plenty of work to gear up for the new semester.
And Jim, you've done some research on the old ISS conundrum about how that hole happened.
Actually, it was Barbara who was looking into that.
Oh, somebody did. I guess I walked in too late on the conversation.
Well, apparently, back in August, cosmonauts were noticing a slight drop in pressure that the big balloon that is the ISS could not keep its air, and they knew that there was a leak somewhere, so they went on almost an 8-hour spacewalk to try to find it.
Yeah.
And it was effectively a needle in a haystack. It was 2 millimeters wide, so there's 10 millimeters in a centimeter and about 2.5 centimeters of an inch, so it was really small, but if it had been any larger, it would have been a much larger threat to the ISS.
Now, I recall the Russians at one point suggested that there may have been sabotage involved.
Right, and surprisingly, one of the comments was that the sabotage may have been from one of the other ISS members, which doesn't really make a lot of sense to me because that is your lifeline and an atmosphere.
Yeah.
But this was in the Soyuz spacecraft that was attached to the ISS. Excuse me. And they have now taken some magnifying devices and really taken a good eyeball to the hole. And it seems as if the hole was punctured from the inside and pushed outward. So you can tell by the microfractures in the metal which way the projectile was pushed through. And also it seems as if there were screw marks near it so that it looks like it was a drill bit.
So maybe an intern was working on that part before it went up?
Well, I don't really know what the state of the Russian space agencies are, but if it's anything like the United States, lowest bidder gets your bid.
Yeah.
And it could have been an oopsie-daisy and nobody wanted to really fess up, but there is an off chance that this hole has been there the whole time, and it just was fortuitous enough that it didn't cause a more cataclysmic problem.
Well, the Russians made some news today. Putin crowing about a new hypersonic weapon that is going to be deployed in 2019. Exciting stuff, yeah?
I think the jury's out on that. I don't really know what a hypersonic weapon would be able to do.
It seems like it would need
an awful lot of energy.
If I remember right, it was almost last year that he said the hypersonic weapon was being prepared. And generally speaking, in the United States, we poo-pooed it, that it wasn't possible.
Well, I think they're still poo-pooing it today.
Well, the funny thing is hypersonic just means faster than the speed of sound, and a typical .22 bullet will go faster than the speed of sound out of a regular rifle. So I don't really know what hypersonic really means, if not to just sound really cool.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a hyped-up cruise missile. There was talk for a while about it being, in fact, nuclear-powered, carrying a nuclear reactor. If that's the case, then it is an extremely dirty sort of weapon. And I was reading about that. The Americans had considered that, of course, in the 50s and 60s, and just kind of ruled it out because it was just an awful.
They worked on that for a long time, the possibility of nuclear-powered rockets.
Yeah. So I think it's good to be skeptical about it.
What about plasma drive? My brother was looking at something yesterday. I was over at his house, and spacecraft using some sort of a plasma drive getting to Mars in 39 days.
Yeah, that's with ions. They take a inert gas like xenon and shoot electrons at it to ionize it and then accelerate it through an electric field like a particle accelerator. Mm-hmm. So these charged particles come out at a very high velocity. So it's an extremely efficient propulsion system. It just doesn't generate much thrust at any given time. So for something like getting from Earth to Mars quickly, where you have a long time where you can slowly accelerate, it's a good way to go.
Yeah, and it's nothing more than a jet engine with a little bit of an ionic charge, because a jet, again, takes a gas and speeds it up and sends it through a small hole in order to get that propulsion. The beauty of having it charged is that you can also kind of accelerate it or decelerate it using magnets or magnetic fields, and that will allow you to use the positive and negative charges of ions to help you out a little bit. So you get it's kind of just an extra boost.
And they've always been talking as well about these giant ion sails, effectively using the solar wind to do the same thing.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, and Jim Pickett are here. And let's take a call or two before the first break. Dan in Saratoga. Dan, you're up.
Good afternoon. So I have a practical science question.
Oh, good.
I have an automatic coffee maker I like to set to brew early in the morning. I have a ceramic coffee mug that I'll set on top of it to preheat the coffee mug with the excess heat that's coming off the top of the coffee maker. My question is it better to have the coffee mug with the ceramic base down, or should I turn it upside down and have the cup hollow and hold on to the heat? What's going to be more efficient warming up that cup, that mug?
Is there actually air, in other words, heated air coming out from the top of the coffee maker?
Or is it just sometimes the surface? You'll see a little bit of steam. You know, it's not made for this. It's just setting it on top of it and accepting the excess heat that's coming off from the boiled water dripping over top of the grounds.
Okay, well, my answer would be that air is a really good insulator. And as long as the air isn't moving very much up above the cup, then you're better off having the cup as close in contact to the surface as you can. But if there's actually steam, for example, coming off of the top of it, then you're better off having it upside down, because that way you'd have more surface area in contact with the steam, and therefore it would warm up the cup more.
I completely agree.
Oh, thank heavens.
Yep, I would go with upside down.
Upside down, allowing the steam to travel inside of the cup and holding it for a longer period of time.
Yep.
As long as your coffee maker generates enough to do that initial warming up of the insulating air, then you'll be good. Now, there's a simple way to check this. You can, of course, put a thermometer in contact with the outside or inside of the mug once you're done, where you care that it is warm, and then see whether our theory bears out in practical language. In fact, if you go to one of the cheaper hardware stores like Harbor Freight, for example, you can buy one of those temperature lasers that'll actually, you just kind of aim it at the thing and it'll read what the temperature is on the outside of the cup.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And they're not that cheap. They're not that expensive.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
It used to be that they were really expensive, but they're not particularly accurate. But for this experiment, it's not, again, like NASA. We're okay if we're off a little.
A little bit. You know, we got for Christmas a... one of those Instapots that has a pressure cooker inside.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a roast on Christmas Day in this thing, and it took like 2 hours. Explain to me in the minute and a half before we take our first break how a pressure cooker cooks quickly like that.
By having
We'll turn your mic on. What happened?
That's right.
There we
do
go.
That.
By having... Don't worry, Zach.
It's
Ed
me.
Did that himself.
Did it.
Yeah, don't worry.
No,
don't push the buttons, he says.
The temperature that water boils depends on the pressure.
Okay.
And if you increase the pressure, if you allow the pressure to increase inside, then the water can boil at a higher temperature.
So you put about 8 ounces of water in,
right.
And then the meat, and then you seal it up.
As long as it's boiling, it's going to stay at the same temperature until the water evaporates. But if you put it under pressure, then you can make it boil at a higher temperature, and therefore the whole thing can cook at a higher temperature.
Right. You're limited to 212 Fahrenheit if you're at atmospheric pressure. Higher pressure, you can go up to 400 or so.
How many atmospheres you reckon are inside the pressure cooker?
The differential is like double. It'll double
it's no
the
more
pressure.
Than two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break here. It's the Science Forum. Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett here to answer your questions. It's 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. Barbara Brabets is here. Jim Pickett and Ed Stander. They are here to answer your questions. And now we go over to Mark in Rock Hill. Mark, you're on.
Hi. Good afternoon, people. I hope you could answer this question. Maybe you've heard it before. I'm hoping so anyway. But every time I watch the news, and particularly the weather on TV, and as you're looking down at the surface of the Earth, they always portray storms as moving in a counterclockwise motion. That's the first part of the question. The second part is that the great spot on Jupiter is supposedly a perpetual storm, and that is also moving counterclockwise. And then the other day, I saw the show, on one of the PBS stations about galaxies, and they portray that as also going counterclockwise, and I'd like to understand why.
Huh.
Well, the storms go counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere and clockwise in the southern hemisphere. And that has to do with the rotation of the Earth, something called...
Would that be the same on any planet?
Yep.
Yep. So, and that's going to be what dictates the rotation of the storms on Jupiter, too.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to understand. If you imagine that you're a horse and you're at the North Pole or you're on the equator... Which horse would have to run fastest to go around the Earth? That's a question.
Okay, I understand, right?
Right? Well, basically what happens is at the equator, they have to run faster. So as you go further and further north, they have to, effectively the winds can go slower and slower and slower. So you get a shear going between a fast wind and a slow wind, and that's what causes the spirals.
Hmm.
I see. And was that a faulty thing to portray galaxies as spinning counterclockwise? Was it just a matter of preference in the visual of the show?
No, as far as galaxies go, galaxies can go clockwise or counterclockwise. There's no effect there. In the case of the solar system, all the planets are rotating, except for Venus, I guess. All the planets are rotating in the same direction, so therefore the storms are in the same direction as the Earth.
Why do you think there's a preference to rotation in one direction over the other in our galaxy, in our solar system?
In our solar system?
Yeah.
Probably because, well, if you can imagine a skater with their hands out, they don't move very fast. And as they bring their hands in, they go faster and faster. So if our cloud that made up our planets, the sun, had a very small motion at the beginning, then as more and more matter winds up in the center where the sun is, it starts going faster and faster, and so it takes one direction or another. So all the planets would be going in the same direction. The only thing that I could add to that that may, you know, make it different slightly is that if there's a planet that was going in the other direction initially, it would wind up hitting something and it would destroy itself.
Right. So because the accretion disk kind of was all one at one point that made our solar system, that's why we're all kind of homogeneous in our direction now?
Yeah. I mean, it was more or less random which way it would go. And as Ed said, it's never good. There never is going to be exactly zero angular momentum in the cloud. So whether it was a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right.
The weird thing made
everything go one way.
The weird thing is that since everything is going counterclockwise, then why do we have clockwise?
Yeah, right. We change the clocks.
Right, we should be going the other direction.
You know, you make a great point, as always, Ed Stander. Barbara Brabbitt's also here, and Jim Pickett. The number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. We go to Mal in Schenectady. You're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm here.
Great.
Hi, the question is, as I understand it, the universe is expanding constantly at an extremely high velocity, and yet there is discussion of seeing the waves from some of the initial waves from the Big Bang. Well, if the universe is constantly expanding at a high velocity, how are we seeing stuff from, you know, billions of years back that is now bypassing us? It seems if everything expanding, you wouldn't see what happened, you know, billions of years ago.
Hey, before they answer this question, Mal, could you just turn that radio down a wee bit?
There you go.
Thank you. All right. Who wants first?
You want to do that, Ed?
I guess I can take it. Basically, imagine this. You've got a star out there. It's 12 billion light years away, but we can see the light of it. How come we can see the light of that star? It's because the light is coming in all directions from that star. It's coming towards us. It's also going away from us. The same thing with any wave that occurred during the Big Bang. Effectively, that wave would be like a drop in a puddle where the wave expands in all directions. And some of that is going to go towards us. So we can picture, we can see it even though it's moving away from us. That makes sense?
Okay. Certainly as much as my understanding goes. So, yes, I'm fine with that.
And the classic way to the analogy for it is the surface of an expanding balloon.
Right.
If you imagine a balloon starting off as just a little tiny dot and then quickly expanding, all the points on the balloon move away from each other. Now, the ones which kind of started off a little further away have expanded, and the light coming from that, from those points, are just reaching us now. Mm. So that's how you can see. When you look far into space, you're looking also back in time. So as far as we can look visually is, what is it, about 100,000 years after the Big Bang, when the universe became clear enough to transmit light. And that's the microwave background radiation. So looking at ripples in that microwave background radiation is kind of looking at the waves from the Big Bang.
Yeah, and another thing to consider is the fact that the universe is expanding slower than the speed of light. So light is actually moving towards us faster than the universe is expanding. So we'll see those effects.
Well, that's not entirely true.
Oh, come on.
In that the farthest places are in fact receding
faster
than the speed of light. We both see things that were beyond our vision before, but then there's other things that are receding that we will never see.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Mal, thank you for that one. It's the Science Forum, and we have with us today Barbara Brabbitt, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett. They're here to answer your questions. And before we get to the next call, Jim, you did some research. We had a call the last time, and
yeah,
it came up again on the show with meteorologist Jason Goff last week, and it was about rainfall. Oh, no.
Cloudiness.
Sunshine. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, here in the gloomy Northeast, it seems that it's cloudy most of the time.
Yeah.
And it's cloudy a lot of the time. I was able to go back into to data that's available online on the amount of solar energy that comes down year by year at several locations in the Northeast. And looking back, I don't remember how far, 20 years back or so.
I think you went to the late 60s, actually.
Yeah. There was no real trend one way or the other in the amount of sunshine, in the amount of solar energy that's received from year to year.
Mm.
So there's a lot of noise from year to year. But
when you say noise, you mean just variations?
Yeah, some years are a little more than others. So if you make a graph, it goes up and down, up and down. But the overall trend is pretty flat.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
And I think the question had to do with solar energy and whether solar is viable in light of global greenhouse concerns. I think that was the original tenet of the caller, were those two things diametrically opposed to one another?
All right, well, back to the phones we go. It's 800-348-2551 here on the Science Forum. Richard in Westerlo. Richard, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to clarify something that was said earlier about the difference between supersonic and hypersonics. Hypersonic refers to anything that's going greater than five times the speed of sound. And it's actually a fairly common term.
Okay.
Well, I think we use the term supersonic.
Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot. No, hypersonic is what we use, but
we did
appreciate that. Okay. So I guess the problem that DARPA and various other agencies are working on is how to cool something down that is going Mach 5.
Yeah. That is definitely a problem. You think of friction of rubbing your two hands together. Imagine if they were going much faster.
In the old days, they had the SR-71 Blackbird.
Yeah.
And that was titanium, right?
That was titanium, yeah. And that would come back smoking hot.
Yeah.
I mean, literally.
Now, the advantage of titanium is it's lightweight and strong. Is it it's soft as well, or...?
Lightweight, strong, and also has good temperature resistance.
Right. Thermal expansion is almost nil. And I think also from a magnetometer standpoint, if you wanted to try to use some kind of detection of ferrous material, magnetic material, titanium comes back relatively neutral. So you can't just look up in the sky and see it.
Yeah. And
with electronics.
And they like making submarines out of titanium for the same reason.
And that's not cheap stuff.
But the advantages are there.
I always wondered about the SR-71. It came after the U-2, and yet it was retired while the U-2 continued to fly. Why?
I think the satellite imagery basically replaced the need for the SR-71.
But yet the U-2 flew. Extent. The SR-71 outperformed it, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, higher, faster. I think the U-2 stayed around because it was used for other research purposes, too. A number of NASA had U-2s, and I think they still
NOAA
fought.
Had U-2s as well.
Yeah. Whereas I think the main mission of the SR-71 was sort of replaced by the satellites.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. That's Jim Pickett. Also here today, Barbara Brabitz and Ed Stander. They're here to answer your science questions on this late December Science Forum. And David in Kingston is on. David.
Hi, everybody. I had a question. I know that there's a lot of information about this self-driving cars. And my question was around a while back, I think a few months ago, a Tesla unfortunately got into a fatal crash, and they blamed it on the fact that the technology could not distinguish between stationary object and moving object once it was going above a certain rate of speed. I think it was 50 miles an hour. I was wondering if you had any insight into why it's not able to distinguish between objects that are moving and not moving.
If I remember right, the computers weren't set up to do it. It was a case of not actually having the computers designed to be able to tell the difference at a certain speed. It was a mistake on the part of the programmers. It wasn't something that the computers couldn't do. Of course, they're able to distinguish that without a problem. So it was just something that was not thought of at the time.
And for those who need a refresher, the circumstances of the crash is you had a bicyclist at night who was going with traffic as they're supposed to. And the Tesla did not see the car, the bike as an object that was one of concern.
All right. Good for you, David.
Yeah, that was really good. I'm just curious. There was another accident where, unfortunately, someone went through a few cone barriers like a day before, and those cone barriers were removed. And the following day, unfortunately, the Tesla went directly into that barrier. Is that the same kind of circumstance where it was completely stationary, was not moving?
I'm not sure because I'm not familiar with that particular scenario. You wonder how high the cone barriers are. I'm just trying to speculate here. Of course, I have no individual information.
Right.
But if the cone barriers aren't high enough, then it could be thought of as part of terrain. I always wondered how a Tesla would do off-road. Like, you know,
Right. Yeah. It's
one thing if it's on a road and the road is mapped and it can kind of store some of that information previously. But if it's learning as it goes onto something that does not have a distinguishable surface that's different from its environment, either a dirt road or a desert, I wonder how it would travel. Probably very difficult for it to do so.
David, thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum on WAMC Vox Pop. Mike in Woodbridge. Mike, you're on.
Hi. Yes, people, thank you for my call. I want to ask you a thought experiment. Now, let's assume that you have two cars, and they're about to break the light barrier, and one car has its headlights on and the other car has its headlights off, and they both break the speed of light barrier. The car with the headlights off, if they switch the headlights on traveling at the speed of light, will the light actually emit from the bulbs or not?
Okay, number one, you can't go with the speed of light.
In a car,
or in anything.
Although we've tried.
Yes.
However.
However, you can get pretty close to the speed of light, but you can't go the speed of light. When you, the whole bit about the light emitting is all dependent upon who's doing the measuring. From the point of view of the people in the cars, the speed of light is exactly the same. They will see the light just come on, boom. Just like you turning on your headlights in your driveway.
Okay.
And that's because time has slowed down for them and their meter sticks have been shortened. So they measure the same speed of light. When you as a stationary observer watching them go whishing past, you will see them as being flattened. And you will see the light coming out slowly from their headlights. So it's all depending on who's doing the measuring, because their clocks and their measuring device gets changed by going at speeds close to the speed of light. It's the weirdness of relativity.
All right, Mike.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for the call.
That'd be cool. We should get some money and try it.
Really?
Yeah.
Some grant money?
A lot of money.
Great idea. Ed Standers here, Jim Pickett, Barbara Bravitz. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the time slowing down, that's been demonstrated experimentally over and over and over again.
Yeah.
There are lots of examples.
We've done it on this show, and we're doing it now, as a matter of fact.
Slowing down.
Interesting. Luke in Springfield. Luke, you're on.
Yeah, just about the SR-71 versus the U-2.
Yeah.
So the question was about why they kept using the U-2 versus the SR-71.
Well, when the SR-71 was retired, and the U-2 kept going,
Yeah, so the SR-71 was a very specific mission. It was just made to outrun a certain type of SAM missile that the Russians had developed. So they developed a missile that could reach the U-2, which made it pretty much obsolete. So they made the SR-71, which could outrun it, basically. But it was very, very expensive. So once they got a missile that could actually get the SR-71, it's all obsolete, and the U-2's got a whole bunch of different uses.
Okay.
And it's a much cheaper platform.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Luke. We appreciate it, and we'll take a break. On that note, the number's 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum, 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll get back to the phones and an email here, but Barbara Bravitz with an important update on atmospheric pressure inside an Instapot.
Yes, I stated that it would be up to 2 times the atmospheric pressure, but those are the old-timey pressure cookers. The Instapot, although it does increase pressure, only does so about 25% above atmospheric pressure. And this goes to about 15.5 PSI.
And this is why it says right on the instructions that you can't can vegetables, for example, with it, because you can't get it to high enough temperature to actually kill everything.
Hey, so time to hit the flea markets and find one of those old pressure
cookers. Dangerous ones that explode. Right. Okay, that's a great idea, Barbara. Yeah, that's on Barbara Bravitz.
That's right.
By the way, how long would it take me to cook a roast on Jupiter?
Not long.
Okay. Well, here's the trick: is on Jupiter, 1 pound on Earth is equal to 300 pounds on Jupiter. So it would be a 1,500 pound roast.
Just enough for the family. All right, this is from Stephen. Came in via email. There's much talk about probiotics in yogurt, sauerkraut, kimchi, etc. Are the organisms able to get past the acid in our stomachs to get to the intestines, where their benefits are greatest?
Yes. They are. FDA does not regulate probiotics, so we assume what they say on the outside of the container is what is there.
For those of us who don't know, what's a probiotic?
A probiotic is mainly it's either beneficial bacteria or beneficial fungi that are encapsulated in kind of a inert phase, and then when it hits the stomach, they're reactivated and they grow under those conditions. And they're meant to do well in digestive systems. And you might take billions and billions of them, but you only need a couple hundred thousand to pass through the stomach and into your duodenum, the first part of your small intestine, in order to be helpful. Those are usually not stomach helpful. They're most of your absorption takes place in your small intestine.
Okay.
And that's where they're really made to do well, especially in high sugar environments.
And of course, the difference is between the probiotic and the antibiotic is the antibiotics kill the probiotics, which is why these things exist.
And if I take an antibiotic because I've been assigned one, I tend to alternate every 6 hours with a probiotic to try to restore the beneficial bacteria in my GI tract.
So if you put a probiotic in a beaker with an antibiotic, would there be an explosion like antimatter?
You'd think, but no. You'd probably just end up with a lot of flat nothingness left over.
And flatulence.
Oh, yes. Well, unfortunately. Not in the beaker. It would escape.
Yes.
Thanks, Ed. All right, back to the phones we go. Jeff in Statsburg. Jeff, you're on.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to say, excuse me, if we picked out a spiral galaxy, which is obviously turning counterclockwise, if we could then just get ourselves out past that galaxy and we turned around and looked back at it, it would appear to be going clockwise. So I think we have to say that every spiral galaxy appears to be going clockwise from half the universe, and it appears to be going counterclockwise from the other half of the universe.
Sounds reasonable.
I think that was part of Ed's point, is there's no perspective for galaxy.
Yes, he did say both ways. They were going both ways.
Yes, but, and the most astronomers will say always from the northern hemisphere. So you're looking down from one hemisphere or the other to be able to define which way it's actually going.
By up in the direction of the North Star?
Well, you're sitting on the North Star looking back at the Earth.
Uh-huh.
It would be going counterclockwise.
All right, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Over to Steve in lovely Plattsburgh. Steve, you're on.
Hi. I have a question regarding the application of fuel cell technology in our climate change world. I understand that a fuel cell makes electricity based on a chemical reaction without any combustion, which is the evil process contributing to greenhouse effect. And I also understand that they've come a long way since the technology of disasters like Apollo 13, and they're reliable and that they can reform the hydrogen out of any fuel and directly produce the electricity, and water is a byproduct and heat. And I'm wondering why there isn't a wider application in a world where we're so concerned about combustion contributing to greenhouse effect.
Yeah, there are a couple of things to keep in mind about fuel cells is that for the most part, they burn things which you have to put a lot of energy into creating. They work best with hydrogen, and the hydrogen has to be generated somewhere, and that requires a great deal of energy. So it's best to think of a fuel cell, at least kind of the common current generation ones, as performing more like a battery, in which you've stored energy in the hydrogen, and then you release it and use it.
But isn't hydrogen the most plentiful element of the entire universe?
Yes. But it's elemental hydrogen that yes. we're burning.
Yep. What do we need to make a fuel cell work?
See, the
hydrogen sticks to everything.
Yeah, the hydrogen, by and large, is attached to oxygen as water in the world. So you have to apply energy to that to convert it back into elemental hydrogen, H2. Mm-hmm. Hydrogens also can be generated from methane, but then you generate CO2. But all of that requires energy to do that. So you can, for transportation, when you need a mobile energy source, it's a perfectly plausible right. thing where you put the hydrogen. Now you run into other practical problems. How do you store the hydrogen? Storing it under pressure is bulky and heavy. There's always been research in trying to store it absorbed in a solid state, but that's always been kind of marginal. It's not worked out.
Why is it marginal?
Well. The technology hasn't worked out well to be able to store a large volume in a small space. There's also a matter of transporting the hydrogen. You can't really transport hydrogen around in a pipeline because hydrogen will cause steel to become brittle and to destroy welds. So there are a lot of technical issues with hydrogen that make it difficult to use in general. For very specific applications, it works really good. So the question for a lot of transportation is whether it's better to use batteries or to use a fuel cell and a stored fuel source. And it's the trade-off there. And right now, batteries sort of are winning.
Yeah, in Iceland, where hydrogen technology really is at the forefront, they have the luxury of dealing with highly reduced fuels already. The fuels are not oxidized. They don't have oxygen associated with them. So it's a little bit cheaper in that they have an energy source. They have
Why do they
the rift.
Have it and the rest of us don't?
Well, because the mantle is pretty thin there, so they have a lot of heat. That's right under their feet. And then along with that comes that reduced fuel, the methane and the natural gases, so to speak.
Ah.
And it's a relatively small place. You don't need a huge infrastructure to outfit an island with that kind of hydrogen economy. Right. And then ultimately, we're oxidizing it to water. That's the end product of the fuel cell. And so you're putting water out into the atmosphere, too, which in the scheme of things is a lot less dangerous than CO2, but at the same time, it does have a global greenhouse effect. If anybody's been hot on a humid day, they know that the same temperature when it's a dry day feels
so
a lot
differently.
So
this is
water vapor that's put out.
And of course, they also require catalysts to operate, and the
expensive
typical catalyst is platinum,
right?
Which is a rather expensive element.
Mm-hmm. If anyone has a catalytic converter, has to replace it, you know that could be a rather expensive proposition. But what about a rich country, say, a desert nation, where you could you recapture the water vapor and then use it for irrigation, let's say?
You could. Yeah, you could create a refrigeration system to be able to remove I don't know how you would do it. Would you have little pots that are attached to the back of your car?
Yeah, no, I'm talking about on a bigger scale. Let's say
right,
Saudi Arabia.
From the atmosphere. Well, then it's really a concentration issue because you've got so little water. You've got some that goes up, and then you have to find a way to run that concentration gradient the other way.
All right, our number here. Go ahead.
But in humid places, you can capture water directly from the air. That's feasible technology.
Right, we do it with our air conditioners, right? We have condensers that do exactly that.
Let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum, and I can see on the CNN here that Putin, once again, crowing about the invulnerable nuclear missile ready to deploy. It's hypersonic. I think John in Castleton wants to weigh in on this. John, you're on.
Hi. just one comment about steam. As far as cooking goes, I was a professional chef for 18 years, and we used to have steam cabinets. that we're low-pressure steam, and steam by its nature, and you were just talking about it, how it feels hotter on a humid day. Well, it also cooks a lot better on a in a steam-jacketed vessel. It doesn't have to be under pressure, though. So instead of boiling, we used to do that for vegetables. Now, this is all anecdotal, so it worked a lot better. So that's one of the things about the Instapot that works good, because it has a little bit of pressure, which will also make things cook a little bit faster because it's also hotter.
Yeah. Well, that has nothing to do with what your subject heading was on the screen here, so I made a terrible seg. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine, because the other thing I wanted to say, because that was an off. The other thing I want to say was we already have hypersonic weapons in development in the form of rail guns.
Yep.
Which are, I understand that they travel about 7 times the speed of sound, but they're very pinpoint as opposed to sludgehammer with a nuclear weapon.
And those are just kinetic weapons, right? Those are not carrying anything but just
force.
Mass and exactly. Speed. Yeah.
F equals MA.
Right, yeah, so that, when they hit something, it gets obliterated because of the kinetic energy, of the weight
exchange.
Of that traveling at 7 times plus the speed of sound.
All right. Well, thank you, John. We appreciate the call on two fronts. We appreciate it. Let's see here. Oh, it's Sean in West Sand Lake. Sean, you're up.
Yes, I was listening to another science program a while ago.
How dare you?
Not this one. Pardon?
How dare you?
Yes, I know. Sorry to offend.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Give me another chance. Yes. It's almost, it's a holiday season.
Sure, yes. Live and let live, I say.
I was listening to it, and they made the assertion, contrary to what you recently said on this program today, about nothing goes faster than the speed of light, and you threw in the word relatively, but they asserted that the universe is expanding faster than
Jim
the speed
said
of
that.
Light.
Jim said just that.
Yes. And the reason that gets a little asterisk and doesn't violate the laws of physics is that because of the expansion of the universe, it's traveling further. So that it's space itself that's expanding. You can't send a signal faster than the speed of light,
right.
But the universe can expand faster than the speed of light.
Ah, yes.
You would never be able to get a signal there, mm-hmm. But because it's the universe itself that's expanding, that gets an exemption.
Mm-hmm. You want to follow up, Sean?
Well, just a quick note that every time you start talking about the universal's law, the speed of light, can't go this or that or other, you always seem to find a twist there that kind of seems to violate that.
Yeah, that's true.
The nature of science.
Yep.
Well, if you want to hear a really good one, there's the fact that the universe is expanding, and we have sort of the edge of the universe that we've defined. But effectively, as with a pebble falling in the water, it's expanding outside of that as well as inside of that. So the expansion of the universe is actually larger than the age of the universe.
Huh.
Expanding into nothingness,
I'll just
the non-universe.
Take your word for it.
Hey, Sean, thanks a lot. Have a great holiday season. Our number is 800-348-2551. But by definition, the universe is everything, right? You can't be outside of it.
That's right.
Some people would argue there's a universe outside of the universe that
well,
we're
how
expanding
could that be?
Into.
A few of them.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go to David in Albany. David, you're on.
I have an answer to the question Ed asked earlier about counterclockwise and clockwise. If I understand the question correctly, it was if the storms turn counterclockwise and the planets are turning counterclockwise, why did we invent clocks to go the other direction clockwise?
Yes.
Is that what you are asking?
That's exactly my question.
So, and by the way, Ed, this is David, your concertina buddy.
How are you, David? I recognized your voice.
Anyway, it has to do with the sun rising and setting. That all happens south of us, that we're in the northern hemisphere. So when the sun rises in the east and traverses the sky to the west, it's going clockwise. And that's what we've designed our clocks to imitate.
Well, that only works for the northern hemisphere. Homo sapiens
started in the
southern hemisphere.
Yeah, but clocks were invented in the northern
hemisphere. They were, yeah. Silly sundial.
Okay. Well, we've straightened that out. David,
thanks
a lot.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
Good luck with
the
concert.
I feel much better now.
Richard in Stuyvesant. Richard, you're on.
Yes, sir. My question is in regard to the ocean's tides, and I wondered if the when it's high tide on the east coast of the United States, if it's low tide on the west coast of Europe.
I would say better that on the east coast when the tide is rising than on Europe on the west coast it's falling. The tides are approximately 90 degrees apart. So you'd have to be approximately 90 degrees from the east coast of the United States to have actually the low tide. The tides are approximately 12 hours apart, or six. Each of the high tides is 12 hours apart. The low tides are between that at 6 hours. And it depends to some extent as well as to where you are, because if you're directly under the moon, then it's 12 hours. But if you're further away from that, then it does vary quite a bit.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Richard.
That was easy.
Appreciate it. Another satisfied customer here on the program. Barbara, do you want to promote anything in the last minute we have here?
Sure. Just to let you know, my classes in science are not yet full for this semester.
Oh, really?
Coming up.
Well, mine are.
Sorry, Ed. Apparently, you're more popular.
Oh, jeez.
What are your classes?
Have to give you a gold star.
What are you doing?
I'm teaching General Chemistry 1, which is a beginner's level chemistry. You need some math literacy and the willingness to work hard.
Okay.
Gen Chem 2 for my students who got through the first half last semester.
Yeah.
They're back for more. I'm teaching biochemistry, which has several prerequisites. And then I have water chemistry,
ooh,
the scariest course I teach.
Why is that?
Because it's really not about the H2O, but everything else that's dissolved in it. And there are threats to human and other biological entities.
This dovetails with your research in the Hudson River?
It does. My Hudson and Mohawk River research, where we're looking for fecal contamination in
right.
the waterways.
And you don't understand why my classes, which are geology and astronomy, fill up faster.
All right. Well, on that happy and somewhat contentious note, we'll wrap up the program. And I see Jim staying out of this. Wise choice, Jim Pickett. Well, support comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. The Arkell Museum in Canajoharie, presenting Portraits and Landscapes, featuring works by Winslow Homer, Fritz Voigt, and Gilbert Stuart, through December 29th. More at arkellmuseum.org. George Heigl Antiques, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in buying and selling antique collections for individuals, families, and businesses, 518-396-7974. And Vermont Coffee Company, organic coffee in the brown paper bag, now roasted with renewable energy. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Thanks again to the esteemed panel for their great work all year long. Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett, they'll be back in 2019. Don't panic. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who will also presumably be back in 2009. No? If, all right, well, we'll find out. Kayleen White took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, John Fisher from the Culinary Institute will be here with his tips for some fancy New Year's Eve cocktails. So get a designated driver and tune in tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for news.